Okay, Brishos Rabbeyava, of course, and it's a big schos to be here. Thank you, Bernie, for inviting me. Good morning, everyone. Enjoy your coffee. Chanukah was a very, very special moment in Rav Amital's life. I'm not sure if it was the transition between the second night and the third night, or the first night and the second night, but that's when he arrived in Eretz Yisrael. So he lit light number two in some internment camp in Cyprus or Turkey, and the third night he was in Eretz Yisrael, and he would actually employ Chanukah as an opportunity to describe his own journey and to discuss sovereignty and messianism, which we'll talk about a little bit later. And in fact, the family got together every Gimel Kislev, the third night of Chanukah, not Gimel Kislev, the third night of Chanukah, for what was the equivalent of a simcha. So of course we weren't invited, but I heard about it from some of the family members. If you had to stack up the six or seven most impactful sichot of Rav Amital, it would probably be the opening sicha, the first day of yeshiva, the famous sicha, in which he tried to calm us down if we were frightened by the great fire of yeshiva. Don't worry, it's all right to be frightened. And the first night of slichos, the first day of Rosh Hashanah, he spoke about Malchus Hashem. The second day of Rosh Hashanah, he spoke, of course, about the Akedah. Chanukah, he spoke about Malchus Yisrael. And then Yom HaTzmut and Yom Yerushalayim. Those were the high water moments in which we absorb Rav Amital's Torah. I want to share some of his ideas. Not much of it is written in very extensive form, so some of it is my own adaptation. So I apologize, I'm not going to constantly say Rav Amital said this and I adapted that, but it's more of a fusion of the two. I think that the drama of Chanukah is so pitched and so stark and so bold. Rabim b'yad me'atim, tamayim b'yad tahorim, spear-carrying Maccabim against trampeding elephants, that it's very easy to historically decontextualize Chanukah. There's another moment in which our Ayyavim wanted to destroy us and annihilate us, and the Baruch Shalom, HaTzurichim Aleim, Hashem Elokei Avoseinu. But by historically decontextualizing, we miss so much of Chanukah's impact, because Jewish history is dotted with moments of salvation and Yeshua. Here are some source sheets of people walking a bit late. And yet Chazal weren't mitaken Yom Tovim and Shiros V'Tishbachos every time the Ribbono Shalom provided a Yeshua. So there's something historically very potent about these two Yom Tovim, which Chazal were mitaken. Now the historical relevance of Purim is unavoidable. It occurs at such a historically sensitive moment. We're stuck in Galus Bavel, both Galus Paris or Madai. The Beis HaMikdash has been launched, but the construction has been halted by those who have opposed Jewish settlement. Sounds familiar. It's in that 18-year gap, and Purim provides the thrust so that the redemption can conclude. In fact, there's a beautiful Sfas Emes. It's an incredible Sfas Emes when you talk about the Zionistic inclinations of pre-institutionalized Zionism, Hasidus, before Zionism went secular. Hasidus was a strong, strong proponent of this Sfas Emes that casts Purim in that fashion. That Purim is a pre-redemptive miracle that lends the thrust so that the ultimate Geula can occur. And he says, and I think that one day we'll once again experience a pre-redemptive event that will lead to the final Geula. It's literally Zionism on display. And Purim has multiple references throughout the Torah, Haster, Haster, Panai, Bar, Durar. So the historical framework of Purim is obvious. It's clear. This isn't just a stark, bare, unadorned confrontation, Lashbid, Largo, Labid, Eskol, Ayudim, but it's history unfolding. Hanukkah's role in history is a little bit more elusive. Doesn't occur at a particular juncture of history in Golos as we're transitioning from exile into redemption. And Rav Amital tried to historically contextualize the Nes of Chanukah. And to do this, he would quote the Sefer Ner Mitzvah of the Maharal. It's a lesser known Sefer, the Maharal. And of course, in our day, the Maharal is very unyielding. It's very difficult to read the Maharal. The Maharal attempts to take classic medieval metaphysics and commonize it for the popular reader. So it's a very, very elaborate system of symbols and iconography and numbers, representations, and it's an attempt to take the classic metaphysics of the Rambam and apply it, and it's very difficult to read, and Rav Amital would very often, but if you strip away the Maharal, there's some very, very deep ideas, but they're
in many cases inaccessible, because that's not the way we think. We're not metaphysicians, we're more existentialists. The famous difference is, if the Rambam tried to defend theodicy, how could HaKadosh Baruch Hu create evil? He's omnipotent, he's benevolent. So according to the Rambam, HaKadosh Baruch Hu doesn't create evil. He only creates good. He can't possibly create evil. He just doesn't distribute good proportionally. So if you're blind, Hashem didn't give you sight. If you're poor, Hashem didn't give you food. If you're hungry, if you're poor, Hashem didn't give you enough money. Now go try telling a poor person, don't worry, it's Mishlech. You're not poor, you just don't have money. Don't worry. It's at an existential level. We're existentialists, so we don't process our world in the same fashion that the metaphysicians did. So the Maharal is metaphysical, and that's why in our context it's difficult to fully appreciate the Maharal. And Rav Amital would strip away some of the shells of the Maharal and provide some of the meaning. So the Maharal provides the historical context for Hanukkah. There are four empires which frame the historical process. And those four empires are alluded to in three different systems of imageries, primarily in Daniel, Perek Beis and Perek Lamed Zayin, in the two respective dreams. And the allegories for the four empires are either metals or animals. In Daniel's dream per se, he sees four animals. He sees the lion, the bear, the leopard or the jaguar, the namer, and then some iron-toothed monster. And Nebuchadnezzar sees a multi-storied statue composed of gold, silver, copper, and then iron. So you've got four different components, and these are referencing four different empires that will visit history, will challenge history, and of course participate in the evolution and the perfection of history. So the Maharal casts Hanukkah as Yavan's moment. Because remember, Babel's moment is clear. Babel dominates the world, Babel destroys the nation. So Babel's confrontation with the Jewish people, and of course it's struggle with history, is clearly outlined in Tanakh, as is Paras or Mandai in the story of Purim. Keep in mind, Hanukkah occurs after the closure of prophecy, after the canonization of Tanakh, so there isn't a clear reference point for the appearance. And Edom's elongated, extended run is obviously unavoidable. But Hanukkah's role, or Yavan's role in this historical trajectory, isn't entirely obvious. But for the Maharal and their mitzvah, it's the Hanukkah episode that represents Yavan's rise, Yavan's challenge, and Yavan's confrontation with Judaism, and of course, impact upon history. Now, for our purposes, of course, we're focusing today on Yavan and Hanukkah, so it's the leopard and the copper that attract the Maharal's attention. Yavan is compared to a namer, just to look at the sources. This is Daniel. When Daniel has his dream in Perek Lamed Zayin, I just want to make sure I can find it here. Right, Perek Zayin, source number 5. Basar Danatz in Aramaic. Afterwards, I saw there was an animal, Varu Achari Kinamar. There was a very strange leopard, the Lagapin Arbadiof, and had four wings that allowed it to extend. And Daniel Perek Beis, which is the Nebuchadnezzar's dream, where he's describing the various levels of the statue, Umalchus Klisa Achari Dinachasha, the Tishlat B'chalara. So there's an empire that's compared to copper. The truth is, there's a third list of four empires, not just the animals in Perek Zion, or not just the copper, not just the metallic allegory in Perek Beis, but the Maharal senses that even at the dawn of history, there was a sense of incorporating these four empires into the historical trajectory. So when HaKadosh Baruch Hu begins creating our world, source number one, Ve'aret Haisa Sohu Vavohu V'choshech Al Pnei Sehom Beruach Elokim Rachem. So before HaKadosh Baruch Hu's spirit enters the scene, there are four different descriptions of a pre-divine or an incomplete or fractioned world. Tohu, vohu, choshech, and tohom. Chaos, oblivion, darkness, and the abyss. So Chazal associated each of these modifiers with a divine empire. Medrash says, Haaretz haisa sohu ze Babel. Dechsev v'yisisaretz v'yinesohu. Vohu ze Haman or Paras Amandai. Dechsev v'yafilu. Without describing why sohu and vohu are Babel and Haman respectively. V'choshech ze Yavan. So the darkness is associated with the Yavan, Shehechshicha Einayim Shol Yisrael B'Gezerosel. Because they dimmed the radiance of the Jewish people through their decrees, through their ideological challenge. So for the Maharal, this is the historical context of Hanukkah. Prior to Hanukkah, Judaism had faced off against savage, barbaric, cannibalistic societies. The savages of Canaan, the warriors of Babel. These were not societies that had developed civilization, systems of governance. These were strong-armed ruffians, thugs, wild, chaotic, nomadic peoples. So that was Judaism's first challenge, to present an image of morality and government and organized society. But now, Judaism is confronting Greek culture. And Greek culture had organized their universe, developed a system of logic, had converted chaos into order. Cosmos in Greek means order. So the cosmos now seemed organized, logical, predictable. And Rav Lichtenstein spoke about this extensively from his vantage point. Obviously, from Rav Lichtenstein's vantage point, it was an attempt to develop a more subtle interaction between Yavan and Judaism. But this was Am Yisrael's first encounter with an enlightened culture, with a culture which, quite frankly, we benefit from and continue to base our societies upon politically, scientifically, philosophically, culturally, aesthetically. So this was a clash of ideologies. And that clash and that attempt of Greece to suppress the Jewish idea and the Jewish concept of monotheism, that is captured by Choshech, attempting to dim, not the chaos and the oblivion of absolute wanton disorder and mayhem of Tohu Vavohu, but of Shechshicha as Einesha Yisrael B'Gzeroseha. There's a subtle point about the word Gezeros, but Rav Amichal didn't talk about then. It's a separate why the term Gezerah appears in the Medrash. And for the Maharal, this is why they're compared, interestingly enough, to both the leopard as well as to copper. Because a leopard, at least in Chazal's world, not enough of a zoologist to appreciate it, but in Chazal's world, a leopard is always associated with brazenness and boldness and audacity. Azkinamer, Kalka Nesher. So the intellectual discovery process, as we know, takes a certain, we wouldn't call it audacity, we'd feel creativity, discovery, the courage to think differently, to shift the paradigm, to see the world as round, not the world as, it takes a certain leap of intellectual faith to see the world different from what it is. So for the Greeks to try to divine or to devise a systemized world took that type of brazenness that would be associated with a leopard and, interestingly enough, would be associated with copper. So today in Hebrew, nachush means you're very obstinate, you're very demanding. And in Tanakh, copper has that double entendre. So when Yeshaya describes the intransigence and audacity and brazenness, source number 4, Midati ki kasha'ata v'gid barzel orpecha, you've got a very stiff neck as iron, u'mitzchacha nechusha, and you're very unabashed, you're very unembarrassed. Your metzach is always employed in Tanakh as metzach ishazona, someone that has no shame and just stands in front of their moral chastisement without any embarrassment, u'mitzchacha nechusha. So this overlap between nechoshes, and I'm not enough of a, someone help me, a metallurgist, someone studies metal, none of a metallurgist understands scientifically why copper is associated. I'm sure there is some reason that copper is associated with brazenness and audacity, but at least in Chazal's system of imagery, nechoshes and namer together compromise or constitute audacity and boldness, and the Greeks had to reinvent or revolutionize a world of ancient savagery into a world of civilization and logic and philosophy and a primitive form of democracy. So this is the historical context of Hanukkah. This was the first time that Judaism was actually facing a worthy opponent. Not savage barbarian, but an enlightened system of government and culture. And the truth is, to a degree, that's why the victory is, so to speak, partial, because anytime ideas engage, there's going to be a cross-pollination and ultimately a corruption. So the Hellenism or the Hellenistic corruption is because ideas are coming into clash and conflict with one another. There's an exchange of information and values, and ultimately Judaism is being not just challenged in an all or nothing contest to defeat it, but it's being corrupted and altered. And to a degree, we sense some of the Hellenistic influences. And ultimately, we live in a world that's deeply, deeply impacted by the entire Greco-Roman tradition. So it wasn't an attempt to defeat it, but they wanted to suppress Judaism, and Judaism survived and was able to incorporate the best and valuable from that culture, which is alluded to, of course, in Rav Shimon ben Gamliel's famous statement, source number 8, that Rav Shimon ben Gamliel, the Gemara Megillah, allows Sifrei Kodesh to be written in Greek amongst all other languages. Why? So Rabbi Yochanan explains, my time in Rav Shimon ben Gamliel, Amar Kra, Yaft Elokim Li'efes V'yishkon Be'alei Shein. The word Yaft is obviously is a play on words. It means to enlarge or to incorporate. But HaKadosh Baruch Hu will allow Yefetz, Greeks, ideas to be incorporated into the house of study, into the tradition of shame. So there's a cross-pollination. Judaism is being challenged and corrupted, and of course we're trying to defend its purity. But ultimately we embrace some of the ideas of Yefetz into a world that is able to synthesize Yefetz and shame. And this is the Maharal's general thrust. Again, it's a short sefer. Much of it is metaphysical, and much of it are classic metaphysical terms of completion and incompletion, fractionality, and God creating absence or God creating presence. But when you strip it down to the bone, this is the historical context of Hanukkah, and it occurs at a very important juncture. So when, for example, years before Hanukkah, when Alexander the Great has this very famous encounter with Shimon HaTzadik and is able to appreciate Shimon HaTzadik and to revere him, because evidently Shimon HaTzadik had appeared to him in various dreams prior to military triumphs, this confirms that Yavan carries value and enlightenment, and it's specifically because of their enlightenment that their challenge represents a shift in history. The Gemara, the Medrash, but it's not in many Gemaras. Source number 6, Asher Ein Bamum, Zayavan Alexandros Mokdon Karhava the Shimon HaTzadik, when he appears to Shimon HaTzadik, Hava Kamlea Raglohi, he stood on his feet and he praised him, and of course the Shimon HaTzadik was able to negotiate more convenient and accommodating terms for the Jewish people, as opposed to some of the other cultures which were trampled by Alexander Mokdon. Yes.
Can you elaborate just one second? It's not quite clear. You're saying that Yavan is enlightened.
Mm-hmm.
Yet the Medrash takes it as a koshuk.
Right. The optics.
Enlightenment compromises our light.
Right. The optics are interesting. So the optics here are interesting because hechshicha creates a sense of a dimness. Well, we use the word enlightenment in a way that I don't think Chazal did. For us, enlightenment, switch the word enlightenment for advancement, development, accomplishment. We use the word enlightenment.
The idiom translates here.
What?
The idiom translates here.
But I don't know of a medrash that associates Yavan with light. You can associate Yavan with aesthetic,
with
beauty.
You're talking about enlightenment. You're talking about that's what you mean.
Okay, but that's my question.
It's worthwhile.
Right, it's worthwhile, but it attempted to employ its cultural strength to dim our message of monotheism.
Okay.
Or if you want, in terms of my previous comments, if the original stage was the face of Judaism versus barbarism and moral debauchery, now it's Judaism versus polytheism. Now the great theological challenge begins. Because they're polytheists, and ultimately now monotheism is trying to defeat a more sophisticated form of, if paganism associated with savagery and brutality, and again, now all of a sudden there's a shift towards a more elegant form of religion as constituted by polytheism. Okay, so that was I think the first general thrust that Rav Amital to try to create the historical context for Yavan by citing the Maharal and seeing Hanukkah as the emergence of Yavan within that litany of four empires that represents an imperfect world, and their encounter with the Jewish people and ultimately their defeat by the Jewish people leads not just to a national triumph but to a more perfect world and a more perfect presence of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And each culture provides its own challenge. Of course, the very famous question with which the Maharal concludes, which I think bothers anyone who reads Daniel, is where's Yishmael? It's a fascinating question. Where are the Arabs in this entire process? So he concludes Ner Mitzvah with a few solutions, but that's obviously not germane to Hanukkah. I think the second issue that Rav Amital would speak about would be the sense of pioneering not just a new intellectual era, but a new historical era. A very famous Rashi in the beginning of Halosva, where Aaron is a bit dejected because he has omitted or has, so to speak, withdrawn from this pageantry to inaugurate the Mishkan. All the other Nisim provided the gold plates and the wagon, and the korbanos, and Nechlesh Adaito Shel Aaron HaKohen. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu consoles him. Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu, source number 9, Chayecha Shelcha Gidola Mishelahem Shatam Madlik Neros Umitivis Aneros. Don't worry, he consoles him with Hadlakas Neros. So the famous question of the Ramban is, of all the elements that a Kohen Gadol enjoys uniquely, that's going to console Aaron. If you were meant to rebuild Aaron's spirit, that you're unique, that you're special, what would you offer him? Minchas Chavitin, Kodesh HaKadoshim, Mari Kohen, you start to sing Mari Kohen. Of all the mitzvot to console Aaron, it's the menorah. That's the famous question of the Ramban. So the Ramban's solution is that the menorah of the Mikdash is really an icon to encapsulate the miracle of Chanukah. That even though all the other gifts and donations of the Nesiim are time limited, when the Beis HaMikdash is destroyed, their relevance will pass, your menorah represents symbolically a miracle that will outlast the Churban Beis HaMikdash. So even though your menorah will no longer be lit after the destruction, it will be the equivalent. So the Ramban comments, I just quoted the entire Ramban, just a very famous Ramban, but just to read the end. Ve'isi Obi Al Mudena, right before source number 12. Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu Moshe. I'm sorry, it's the top of the page. Remez min haparsha al Chanukah Shenero, Shaisa Vaisheni, Aide Aaron Uvanov, Ritzoni Lomer Chashbonoi Kohen Uvanov. Somehow, the fact that the menorah of the Beis HaMikdash evolved in the Nes of Chanukah was a consolation for Aaron. Rami Tal felt that Aaron wasn't just despondent because of a missed opportunity. Aaron was despondent because he missed an opportunity to be a pioneer, to launch a great event. Dedicating gifts to the Beis HaMikdash, to the Mishkan, is not just a mitzvah of tzedakah or a korban. This is the launch of an enterprise, of a project, of an era of prophecy, of an era of revelation. There's a certain appeal about pioneering a new era, a historical shift. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu therefore can console him with the yearly, annual entry into the Kodesh HaKadosh, and that's meaningful, that's potent, that's very invigorating, but it isn't pioneering. The Minchas Chavitin is very routine, every day, Machtzisa B'Boker, Machtzisa Bein Arbayim. But the chance to engage in a mitzvah that would then segue into the miracle of Chanukah, which is an opportunity to pioneer a new era, that was an equivalent. That was a compensation for Aaron HaKohen. And Chanukah, hence, is not just an intellectual shift, where now Judaism is not just confronting savagery and barbarism, but confronting an enlightened or culture, but it pioneers a new era. And that new era, as odd as it sounds, is the era of exile. Essentially, Chanukah is the pre-exilic, final miracle, final pit stop before it was clear to the Jewish people at that stage in history that the long night of Gullus was soon to emerge, that the second Beis HaMikdash was a pale shadow of its predecessor, that only 42,000 Jews had returned, and the ensuing period merely punctuated and reinforced that, the civil strife, the internecine struggle, the infiltration of the Tzdukim. So Chanukah is that last moment before the Jewish people begin the long odyssey through exile, and it provides some of the thrust to allow us to survive exile. So one of the legacies of Chanukah is Torah Sheba'al Peh. Torah Sheba'al Peh erupts. It's a supernova that erupts in the wake of the heroism of Chanukah. Torah is always hitched to Jewish identity and Jewish energy. There are 6,000 boys now learning in Lakewood, 50 miles from here. It's because we have Medinas Yisrael. They're not aware of it, but we need pride. We need Kol Miyut in order to fuel. Torah is our expression of Kol Miyut. So Chanukah's heroism, moral invigoration, commitment yields this explosion of Torah Sheba'al Peh, which is essentially the hallmark of the rabbinic era that allows us to survive Gullus. So ultimately, Chanukah is a pioneering opportunity in place of the opportunity to pioneer the era of revelation which the Beis HaMikdash or the Mishkan heralded. And to a sense, I think it's very reflective of what Rav Amital saw himself as a pioneer. When he built his yeshiva, it wasn't just another yeshiva. It was a yeshiva to create a new model on two fronts. That's what made it so inspirational and aspirational. On the one hand, he felt that the classic yeshiva model had become ossified and fossilized, and we couldn't just preserve and recycle the European yeshivas. There had to be a new form of a yeshiva. Tanakh and Machshava had to be studied seriously. The role of the Rebbe had to be reinvented. Distance had to be replaced by familiarity and accessibility. For me, coming from a yeshiva world, I have fond, not so fond memories. My lungs don't have fond memories. I went to Kamenetz. So I would skip out of class and visit the Bachrim in the Kollel, the Nevada Torah with them. It was like walking into a chimney stack. I mean, to walk into that room, everyone was smoking three packs a day. And then when I came to yeshiva, no one was smoking. It was strange to me. Are these yeshiva Bachrim? Where are the cigarettes? Things which, Baruch Hashem, we take for granted today, I think were very much launched during that era. And quite frankly, in ways that I'm not sure the YU world was as advanced, particularly by Soloveitchik, I'm sure by Adler can comment more. I think he represented more of the Lithuanian rabbi who would chastise, well, less than his later years than Denver, but it was a very, very different role of a yeshiva, very different curriculum. And ultimately, the double revolution or the double pioneering was he was also trying to present Hesder to the broader secular Israeli audience. So on the one end, he was reinventing the classic yeshiva. On the other end, he was trying to provide a model that the secular public would buy into, because Hesder was not something which was obvious. Karen Vyavne existed, but it wasn't a platform. It wasn't an ideological statement. It was a yeshiva for boys who couldn't learn in Panavish. They needed a place to learn. All of a sudden, let's try to convince the secular public that Hesder is appropriate, Hesder is legitimate. And that's why sometimes I'll hear a board who will still tell me today that, remember if Amital once said, remember that if you don't daven in the yeshiva, you shouldn't daven in the yeshivman, you should daven in your room, so I'm going to daven in my room. Of course I slap them in the face and they say, stop being an idiot. In those days, Israelis davened very, very early. The entire schedule was different. And he was very worried that the public shouldn't see Hesder boys as lazy, as indolent. So most of the minyanim would finish at 6:30 or 7. The entire workday began much earlier. So if all of a sudden herds of yeshiva bachrim would walk into the yeshiva minyan, people would start to mock yeshiva boys. Oh, we all get up at 6. Today, thank God, in the Lomshfut, which is where the yeshiva is located, you have a minyan at 7, 7:10, 7:20, 7:30, 7:40, as I imagine you do in Teaneck. So for a boy to daven, of course, we strongly encourage them to daven the yeshiva minyan, of course. But if a boy misses the yeshiva minyan, of course, you should daven with a minyan in the yeshiva. Or, for example, most yeshivas in Eretz Yisrael end Rosh Chodesh Nisan and begin Rosh Chodesh Iyar. But in yeshiva, the minag is, and now it's began to infiltrate other Gush-inspired yeshivas like Yerucham and Baalei Adumim, that we end Vav Nisan and we begin Chaf Zayin Chaf Ches. Why? Because when you're off from the army, you have 2 weeks off, maximum, and you have to rush back to the army. But all of a sudden, during the time that you're in yeshiva, during your five-year Hesder service, you have a month off and you relax. It would create an offset and an imbalance that would lead people to mock or to scorn yeshiva bachrim. So he was very conscious of pioneering a new yeshiva. He told us this very interesting story. He was once traveling home from Tel Aviv, and he heard on the radio a story of a blaze in a multi-story building in Manhattan, and there were children trapped on one of the upper stories, standing by the windows, and the parents were standing beneath this building, pleading with the children to jump into the mattresses, into the nets, and the children were terrified. They didn't jump. Parents were screaming and pleading. Hear this on the radio about an event that took place in New York City, and the children, of course, died of smoke inhalation. They burned. He felt that was such a tragic story. He arrived home and gave up Mordechai. He's walking home. And he sees there's a fire in an apartment building. So he bangs on the door. He breaks through the glass, the equivalent. And he saves a woman. Then he calls the woman out and he saves her life. And he saw this as a sign from HaKadosh Baruch Hu that I mean, he felt the tragedy of the New York City incident was that one generation sometimes doesn't have the language to communicate with the younger generation. The parents' message just wasn't fully appreciated by the children. This would save their life. Hashem HaKadosh Baruch Hu had given him the ability to communicate with the younger generation. And even as he grew older, I would pass him by in the office, and he would make these little comments to me, or even in his speeches, how proud he was that he could continue to communicate with younger boys as he turned 70 and 75 and 80. It was very important to him that people still felt that his message was relevant and that he had a common discourse. So he clearly saw himself as pioneering. Interestingly enough, mentioning boldness and courage, I think those who knew him very, very well appreciated how courageous he was, how bold he was. On Gimel Kislev was the day that they first came to the yeshiva in 1968. So a few weeks ago, we started our 3-year, 50th year celebration. Jewish institutions stretch the 50th year. So we started our 3-year, 50th year celebration in year 49. So we had a banquet in the yeshiva, and we invited a boy who had attended, who was now a 70-year-old man, was part of that first group, Yeshaya Yechieli. So he read from his diary. Some of these stories are just amazing, just for those who would appreciate it. Rav Amital was starting the yeshiva, and the Rabbanim and Nativ Meir, the high school, were discouraging the boys from attending Gush, because it was a new yeshiva. But everyone knew that the two top boys, if they'd be recruited properly, and if they came to the new yeshiva, then everyone would follow. So who are the two top boys in the Tiv Meir of 1968? Yaakov Maidan and Elio Bluenzweig. Everyone was going after Yaakov Maidan and Elio Bluenzweig to recruit them to come to the new yeshiva. So anyway, evidently there was a parlor meeting in Rav Amital's house in Givat Mordechai. He was recording, and one boy got up and said, "Rebbe, it's Kfar Etzion, there are Arabs, it's a wasteland, 1968. I'm scared to go." So evidently Rav Amital raised his finger and said, "Mi ha'ish ha'yarei v'racha leva v'yelech v'yashav." And another boy said, "But there are girls, it's a kibbutz, how can we have a yeshiva with a kibbutz?" "Mi ha'ish ha'yarei v'racha leva v'yelech v'yashav." Any question they asked, he said, "Okay, so if you're frightened, then don't join." There's a certain sense of courage and lack of fear, and someone had lived through the Holocaust on so many fronts and had faced death so often, that very little got to him, very little overwhelmed him. And when I was preparing the shiur and thinking about Azken Amer and the boldness of the Greeks, I said we don't need the Greeks to teach us about boldness and courage. So it was that second sense of pioneering, of refreshing, very beautiful Sfas Emes, which he would quote to us, that when Chazal described the time frame for lighting Ner Chanukah, so it's roughly, about a half an hour after Shkia or after Tzeisa Kochavim, because the mitzvah demands Pesumei Nisa. So Pesumei Nisa is only enabled if there are people to witness the Ner Chanukah. But they have a very strange way of articulating that time frame. Achit Tichle Regel Min Ashuk. What did they say? Chatzisha. It's a very strange language. Tichle regel min ashuk. So the Sfas Emes, I think he quotes his grandfather, Chiddush Yerim, doesn't, that Chanukah is an opportunity to refresh, to renew, to innovate, to break habits, to break out of ruts, to break your hergel. That's a tichle hergel min ashuk. Because we're all stuck in routine, we're all stuck in day-to-day commonality, and breaking those cycles is a unique opportunity to Chanukah. And that sense of pioneering, not just historically, but pioneering in our own personal experiences. But possibly, I think, the most famous and most important theme, which was repeated to us so often on Chanukah, and to me is really one of his lasting legacies and how he impacted the world of religious Zionism in ways it's still evolving, is his discussions with us about Malchus Yisrael. When the Rambam describes the Nes of Chanukah, in the very outset, he doesn't mention the Nes Shemen. Oil is delayed until the second halacha. The Rambam describes Chanukah, source number 12, the Vayisheni. Remember, Chanukah isn't described in Tanakh, so it's absolutely necessary for the Rambam to articulate the events. We don't read of it in Tanakh. He describes the attack, the assault, Pashtu Yadam, Bimimonam, Uvivnoseim, Acherichem Aleim, Elokei Avoseim, Vihoshiyim, Miadam, Vitzilam, Vigavru, Vinei Chashbonaya, Konim HaGedolim. Last line, boldface. The Chazra, Malchus, the Yisrael, Yisrael, Masayim Shem. Now, obviously, those 200 years of Malchus were quite possibly 200 of the darkest and most pathetic years of Jewish history. The community was in shambles, fissured by strife, stukim, prushim. The Malchus of those 200 years, roughly, between the miracle of Hanukkah and the Churban Beis HaMikdash Sheni, were not celebrated years of Jewish history. The leadership was flawed. The Gemara in Kiddushin says that if someone approaches Sanhedrin, informs them that he belongs to the Beis Chashmonai, we have to assume he's a non-pedigreed Eved or a Shivcha, because within two or three generations, the Chashmonaim were a massacre that annihilated because they usurped the throne of the Ban Reitzin Partisvayichi. And the only people to escape were some slave hands or some servants. So the irony is, person approaches Basin with great pride, I belong to B'nai Chashmonai, and you've disqualified yourself to marry a pedigree Jew. So the sovereignty was fledgling. The experience was pathetic. The leadership was flawed. And yet we celebrate 8 days of Malchus, 8 days of Hallel. And the Rambam doesn't pivot this on the Shemin. The Rambam doesn't hitch this to the Shemin. He just hitches it to Chazar Malchus L'Yisrael. And for Rav Amital, and to me this is probably one of his most powerful statements, when Jewish people experience sovereignty, when HaKadosh Baruch Hu allows us the right of self-governance and self-determination, we recite Hallel for 8 days, regardless of its caliber, independent of its leadership. Chazar Malchus Yisrael is a standalone, self-sufficient warrant for 8 days of celebration. And in the very, very heady and giddy religious Zionist discourse of the last 40, 50 years, this is what I would call a tempered form of redemptive consciousness. Redemptive consciousness can play tricks on the mind, can lead to very, very radicalized opinions, can lead to all or nothing ambitions. And living through those two very, very traumatic post, I would say, second generation State of Israel events, the first generation, 48, 67, 73, of these great victories, the giddiness, the triumph, and then the tempering of expectations, and then those two traumatic events, the Oslo Accords and the disengagement. And for many people whose redemptive consciousness was accelerated to unrealistic expectations with the anticipation of immediate redemption and complete return, these were very, very catastrophic and devastating moments. I mean, there are thousands of 30 to 35-year-old Israeli people, Israeli young adults, who no longer are, it's hard to classify people today in Israel, but certainly are struggling with their faith and their religion. Because in 2006, when they were 13, 14, and 15, and the disengagement was about to occur, so much of the rabbinic leadership of the religious Zionist world stood up and announced for completely, it's embarrassing that such great people could issue such statements 70 years after the Holocaust. Hayolotiyah. It won't happen. They guarantee that HaKadosh Baruch Hu won't let it happen. I don't know how anyone, 70 years, HaKadosh Baruch Hu can allow the Holocaust to happen. He can allow 8,000 Jews to be resettled by a Jewish government. Okay, we're adults. We can process extremities. We can process imbalanced positions. But if you're a 15-year-old Israeli high schooler and all the rabbis you revere guarantee that it won't occur, what happens if the next day it does occur? It leads to a terrible, terrible crisis of faith that I don't think we have yet to recover from. And for Rav Amital, that whole, I call it, redemption veiled by fractionality. It can be redemptive even though it's fractional, even though it's partial, even though it's incomplete. Reshus Mechaski L'Aseinu does not imply an immediate leap and a rapid overhaul. It's a process, and the process can experience surges, and it can experience pauses, and it can experience regressions. And I think that in a much more, I don't want to say mature, but tempered, and I think we, for those of us in this room, and the people who can probably articulate this better than I can, I think we receive that cautious redemptiveness on both ends. For Rav Amital, was very much living in the shadow of the Holocaust and sensing the vulnerability of the Jewish people. And he always saw Am HaYoshev Yitzion as an Ud Nitzal Miyesh, as a remnant of a lost world. He was very cautious and conservative about protecting a very vulnerable group of people. And Rav Lichtenstein was just very, very temperate as a person. His whole personality was very moderate and very cautious and very conservative. And together they built an attitude and a consciousness that on the one hand was deeply engaged in this process of Reshus Nechazul Hosseinu and building the land. I remember a few years before Rav Lichtenstein was honored, before he passed, he was honored and he received the Israel Prize, which is the highest non-military prize awarded. And in his interview he said, "Who would have thought that I was such a Zionist?" Like he said in his cute way, he felt responsible for the rebirth of the entire Gush and the entire Gush area. And I'm a Lithuanian Talmud of Rabbi Soloveitchik. Who would have thought that I'd be something to that nature? And in a very quiet way, he built facts on the ground. And his yeshiva led to a growth of an entire neighborhood, which we call Gush Etzion, which, but thank God, has made a major shift in Israeli demography. And Chanukah was that chance for Avraham Mital to emphasize that Malchus Yisrael is valuable and cherished regardless, even if it doesn't reach the levels that Rav Kook describes on page number 2. Medina Zu, Ve'es HaYotzer Elyona B'Sula Ma'usha, very poetic and aspirational. Medina Zu Hu Medina Seinu Medina Yisrael Yesod Kisei Hashem Ba'olam, the foundation, the infrastructure of Hashem's presence in this world, Shekol Chatza, the entire agenda of the state of Israel, She Hashem Echad Rishmo Echad, Shezeu Be'emes Ha'usher HaYoter Elyon. Our state of Israel doesn't reflect HaKadosh Baruch Hu's presence at every moment. I don't feel that our government officials always act in accordance with this vision. And you can almost see in front of your eyes this, I wouldn't say split is too harsh a word, but this slight striation between students of Rav Kook, who are very strongly influenced by these very, very absolute definitions of Medinas Yisrael, and when Medinas Yisrael starts to veer from those expectations, it creates a lot of uncertainty and discomfort. And Rav Amital's more Chazal Malchus Yisrael, the Malchus that's imperfect, the Malchus that's flawed, but still deserves our attention and our celebration. Even to the point that today, as my children tell me, in the Dati Lumi world in Israel, it has become subdivided into two groups. You're either a Kavnik or a Gushnik. And a Kavnik suggests that you're more inspired by the Meshivas of Rav Kook, Merkaz Harav, Har Bracha, Har Mori, Mor Moreh, Rav Kal. Or you're a Gushnik in which you're inspired by some of the yeshivos and Rabbanim who have followed that path, Malei Adumim and Yerucham and Rav Shurlo and Kfar Batya and some of the people that are probably more familiar to the audience here, because I think many people here see themselves in that profile. The Kohen Gadol would daven, I forget whether this is after he leaves the Kodesh HaKadoshim or during Kriyas HaTorah, but source number 13, the Rambam, Mevarach HaYisrael Bracha Bifnei Atzma, Shioshia Hashem es Yisrael v'lo yasser mehem melech. Of all the things to daven for Yom Kippur, v'lo yasser mehem melech, for Jewish sovereignty. And notice the Rambam doesn't quote at this moment Melech Yehuda, Melech Tzadik, yasser mehem melech. A little bit later, the Rambam Tal contrasted it with a different tefillah. I think this is the one during Kriyas. I think the first one is during Kriyas HaTorah. The second one is when it leaves the Kodesh HaKadoshim, v'lo yasser shevet mebeis Yehuda. So this contrast, our ideal is the Shevet Mebeis Yehuda, which constitutes a righteous king, and a king whose monarchy is in concert, and synonymous with Kisei HaKavod, Kisei Hashem, as opposed to the previous tefillah, Le'yasser Melech Meisrael, just the ability to appreciate a melech. And there really was a second part to that, I would say, more rationalized, pragmatic, tempered redemptiveness. It wasn't just the ability to see in our sovereignty, as imperfect as it is and as flawed as our leadership is, the hand of HaKadosh Baruch Hu in closer celebration. There's also the ability to see revelation when it's veiled in pedestrian and common experiences. So Zechariah describes, and Zechariah is a highly apocalyptic sefer, so Zechariah describes the redemption in ways that don't sound too apocalyptic. Source number 16, Karamar Hashem Tzevakos, Od Yeshu Zakenim Ruzakenos Berchovos Yushalayim Ish Mishantobi Adami Rav Yamim Urchovos Air Yimalu Yiladin Bilados Mitzachim Berchovoseha Karmar Shem Tzavakos. These are scenes that are quite normal, pastoral, women and men walking through the streets on their canes, children frolicking, These are not candelabras in heaven, as the beginning of Zechariah presents, or four horsemen, or they're simply very pedestrian, common, natural scenes. And yet they're embedded in the prophecies of Zechariah, which typically are apocalyptically inclined. And the answer is that what's normal for most nations has been elusive and apocalyptic for the Jewish people. How long have we struggled to achieve moments in which people can just stroll freely through streets of Yerushalayim with their canes? Our ancestors weren't privileged to that because they never aged to that level, because they were prematurely murdered or massacred. And we're still not there. I mean, over Shabbos, I'm sure our children, Sderot, couldn't freely walk through Sderot because of the sirens and because of the bomb shelters. And the fact that we've achieved, by and large, these common elements of statehood, running our own government, dictating our own future, it isn't messianic. It doesn't carry messianic luster. It isn't a complete shift of a complete overhaul of human experience. But the ability to see that as redemptive and to appreciate, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu actually reminds us that as normal and common as it seems, it is apocalyptic by a verge of just astounding. Everyone knows the prophecy, but I don't think enough people read the next passage. Kor Amar Hashem Tzivakos Ki Yipalei Be'inei Sheiris Am Hazeh Ve'yamim Ahem Gam Be'inei Yipalei Nu Hashem. Those who will live to see this will be shocked. I'll also be shocked, which is, of course, impossible. What's so shocking about elderly people walking in streets of Jerusalem with canes and children frolicking? Because the trajectory of Jewish history is different. We aren't affected by the same rules of history. And as we rise meteorically, and as we fall precipitously. And somehow this jagged trajectory of history renders even common expectations apocalyptic. Even the ability to walk freely through the streets of Yerushalayim is shocking, and it's so shocking hyperbolically that it shocks even a Kodesh Baruch Hu. And I think really that's really the lasting legacy of Rav Amita. I remember a couple of years ago, in terms of how he affected modern Zionist thought, a couple of years ago I was interviewed by the New York Times. So the correspondent asked me, what do you think about settlers? I said, I'm a settler. He said, what do you think about settlers who carry guns? Those days, I still carried an Uzi. I said, I carry a gun. Said, no, those settlers who carry guns, who believe that every centimeter of this land will one day be theirs. She was trying to bait me into defaming Hebron settlers. And I refused to debate it. So she said, well, you look different, you sound different, you're college educated. How would you describe yourself? I said, I believe in the same messianic agenda that the settlers you speak of believe, but that doesn't acquit us from following pragmatic concerns, ration, halacha. I described halacha to her, respecting the rights and the needs of those who currently live in the land. But it doesn't make me less messianic. It just means that the techniques I employ to advance my messianic agenda are a little bit different. They're the classic techniques. Shabtai Tzvi gathers his followers in 1666 around the campfire, and they're reading Chazer, and they recite the Bracha, Baruch Ata Hashem, Elokeinu Melech HaOlam, Matir Yisurim. If you want a fancy word, it's called antinomianism. The notion that in a post-redemptive era, we can make a break with classic demands and strictures of halacha. And I think that grounding in the world of pragmatism, respect for international law, respect for other people's rights, and of course, absolute adherence to halacha, and somehow merging all of that into a redemptive consciousness, and one that's tempered, and one that's has patience and historical forbearance rather than historical impetuousness, and expecting the redemption to happen overnight, and being able to outlast sad regressions and pauses such as those we've experienced. I think that's something that he deeply, deeply embedded in his Talmidim, and Baruch Hashem, in a place such as this, in a community like this, I think it's in the water. I think you feel that and you hear that, and I think he's largely responsible for that. I think that if, to a degree, if the Rav Kook ideology had solely driven the Hasdur world, I think we'd have a very different brand of religious Zionism. And I think it was healthy that both Rav Amital, given his Holocaust perspective, was such a product of not just his boldness and his courage and his vision, but his whole life was driven by the specter of the Holocaust. And what made it so amazing was that most people walked away from the Holocaust with shame or guilt. Why was I chosen? Why did I survive? Why did other people die? And for Avamital, it was just mission. He just felt as if he had been spared to make a change, and Hashem had a plan for him. And for Rav Lichtenstein, again, we always mourn in the United States Rav Lichtenstein's migration to Israel and how YU would have been different if Rav Lichtenstein had remained. Remember, he succeeded in infusing the Lithuanian spirit into a Hesder world that was clearly being driven by Rav Kook's Talmid. Hanan Parad and Yoel Ben Nun and that whole movement. So what would Hesder look like today if Rav Lichtenstein had not migrated to Eretz Yisrael and brought Rav Soloveitchik and with others? It wasn't just Rav Lichtenstein, but certainly that firepower that he introduced to Gush and by extension stabilized. I mean, one could even question how many Americans would be traveling to Israel to study in yeshivos if Rav Lichtenstein had to move to Eretz Yisrael, because many of the originals, obviously Yerem Yavin was the first movement in the early 60s, middle 60s, even late 50s, but in the 80s, in the 70s, people started to study with him, and it became, there was a world of yeshivas in the Hesder world that still reflected the Lithuanian model because of others, with Goldbach and Kerem Biavna and others in other yeshivas. But to have such a person of such stature, and this is really bleeding into Rav Lichtenstein, and representing the Hesder world, stabilized yeshivas that were similar in that spirit, and together they provided, I think, a very tempered, moderate, patient, balanced, and poised sense of redemption. And we're not less messianic if we're more pragmatic. And we're not less visionary if we see a larger trajectory. And we're not less redemptive if, in theory, obviously today it would be a joke to suggest it, but in theory, if we exchange plans with people, it doesn't make us less redemptive, it makes us, if anything, more so. So these were the three points, the bullet points that I wanted to highlight. The historical framing of Hanukkah as representing this first encounter between cultures, or between the cultures of enlightenment, cultures of morality, cultures of logic, cultures of science. Number two, the historical shift. This was a chance to pioneer a new era prior to the long gullus. Hanukkah provided the thrust and the energy, and in particular, the explosion of Torah Shabbat, which is really the legacy of Hanukkah. There's no political impact, long-lasting. 200 years after Hanukkah, the Romans completely erased any vestige of Hanukkah. 200 years after Hanukkah, lo noda kibal kurbana, to borrow from Parshas Mikra, it's impossible to realize. You don't sense any impact of Hanukkah. But the explosion of Torah Shabbat, which is driven by the energy of Hanukkah, is the pioneering moment for the period of Gullus that allows us. That's why I believe there's a machlokas, the Rambam and the Ravid, about what elements of Purim will remain after Mashiach. But it's pretty clear that Purim will be celebrated after Mashiach. So whether we'll read Megillas Esther or we'll actually perform mitzvos, but no one claims that Hanukkah will outlast Mashiach. There'll be no vestige of Hanukkah. Hold on to Hanukkah. It may end soon, hopefully. Because Hanukkah's purpose is to launch the period of Gullus and to provide some of the firepower into other aspects, not just Torah Shabbat Peh, but Kiddush Hashem, the Makarim, the many elements of Hanukkah, but that's really a different shear. But once Mashiach arrives, once we have a Messianic era, so Hanukkah is completely outlasted in function. We just don't have the vestige, so to speak, because its purpose is to bridge and to mediate that odyssey through Gullus. And the third aspect, which I think is probably the most important one, is Malchus Yisrael. This was a time for him to temper our expectations, help us appreciate what we received through his own personal experience. He was speaking autobiographically. And to create, I think, a very, very healthy and anchored sense of religious Zionism, which I think, thank God, Baruch Hashem, is proliferating today amongst the religious Zionist world, amongst the Hasidic yeshivas. So everyone should have a Chanukah Sameach, Chagurim Sameach. It should be the last year we celebrate Chanukah. Hey Mark, good to see you again.
See you.
Good. Time comes every once in a while.
Yeah.